AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580. This August 9th, 2009, we have a terrific show for you today. We have with us, joining us on the phones, one of the really outstanding emerging young investigative journalists of our times, the author of several books and numerous articles on topics ranging from Afghanistan and Iraq to the prison crisis and the state of civil liberties in the United States. It's going to be a great hour with Christian Parenti. I think you're going to enjoy it. But before we get to our guests, let's first go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
The Internet Freedom Preservation Act, a bill that would protect so-called network neutrality and establish rules of the road for an open Internet, was introduced in Congress last week by Democratic Representatives Edward Markey of Massachusetts and Anna Eshoo of California. Calling the Internet an essential infrastructure, Markey said that the national economy would be severely harmed if content, service, and application providers were slowed down or blocked by broadband network operators. Free Press campaign coordinator Misty Perez-Trudson says the bill would put net neutrality protections into the law once and for all.
The law would prevent Internet service providers from controlling our access to content, services, and applications on the Internet. This means that we will continue to be able to enjoy the open Internet as it is today, without corporate gatekeepers controlling what we can access on the Internet.
As more information, entertainment, and communications move online, phone and cable companies are viewing the Internet as a direct threat to their bottom line and traditional business models.
Rather than adapt and welcome new innovative models, phone and cable companies are scrambling for control of the Internet in order to drive traffic towards their sites and to turn up their profits while shutting out competition.
Without a law that keeps the Internet open to all competitors, she says, we could lose our freedom to pick and choose where we want to go online.
Whether it's access news and information, or communicate with our family members across the nation or around the world, or whether it's look up our favorite movie and watch it online. Without that access, the Internet will change. It won't be the open Internet that we've all become accustomed to. It will be an Internet controlled by Internet service providers.
This is the third time that a net neutrality bill has been introduced in Congress. Perez-Trudson says that a different climate in Washington and the growing importance of the Internet for economic development and democratic participation increase the chance of the bill getting passed.
I think the bill's going to pass this time because we have a pro-network neutrality president, the chair of the FCC is very supportive of network neutrality, and the public support is continuing to grow and only getting stronger.
For more information about the Internet Freedom Preservation Act and net neutrality, go to savetheinternet.com.
The Transmission Project is on a mission of its own, to amplify the power of public media and community technology. They place AmeriCorps Vista volunteers in nonprofit organizations across the country. Belinda Rollins is the executive director of the Transmission Project, formerly known as CTC Vista. She says that as the nearly 10-year-old program grew, the organization eagerly took on opportunities to expand the scope of their work beyond their original efforts to place volunteers at community technology centers.
As the CTCNet membership started to expand beyond the very traditional one-room computer centers and housing developments, church basements, community centers, and started to incorporate more organizations that were involved in media arts, public access television, all sorts of different technology centers, the mission of CTC Vista started to broaden out to incorporate a wider variety of organizations.
The name Transmission Project reflects the evolution of the effort. Rollins explains.
We needed to come up with a word that would actually cross different technologies, cross disciplines. So we're actually going across missions, transmission, around public media and public technology in the country.
Public media is central to the work of the Transmission Project, but their definition of the term expands beyond the familiar outlets of PBS and NPR. Instead, Rollins explains that a range of media, from public access television to wireless mesh networks, can be public media if they are accessible by the public and utilized for the public good. Volunteers are working with a wide range of organizations this year, such as the New Entry Sustainable Farming Project in Lowell, Massachusetts.
They are working to develop distance learning opportunities for rural, independent, and organic farmers nationwide. So we've placed someone with their organization to help them to develop the strategy to not only create that delivery system for the learning opportunities, but also to then do the outreach campaign and fundraising campaign to make sure that it continues on at the end of the year.
Transmission Project also placed a volunteer with Reclaim the Media, a Seattle-based media reform group.
Reclaim the Media in Seattle is working on a digital media literacy curriculum that will be used both with organizations nationwide and also individuals in their communities.
To learn more about the work of the Transmission Project, visit transmissionproject.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL, AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today is one of the really outstanding emerging investigative journalists in the United States today. Christian Parenti is the author of three books that have all been highly praised, works of investigative journalism, starting with Lockdown America, Police and Prisons in the Age of Crisis from 1999, The Soft Cage, Surveillance in America from Slavery to the War on Terror from 2003, and then The Freedom, Shadows and Hallucinations in Occupied Iraq from 2004. He's been working on Afghanistan in recent years. He writes widely for The Nation magazine, and he's involved in the highly acclaimed new documentary on Afghanistan called Fixer, which we'll be talking about today. It's a pleasure to welcome Christian Parenti to Media Matters.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Well, yeah, Christian, there's so much ground I want to cover. We haven't had you on the program before. In any of the books you've written, and of course your work in Afghanistan alone would fill up an hour easily. Let's start, though, and work backwards if we can, and talk about Fixer, the film that you're in that has received the great reviews that just came out. And it is an extraordinary film. I've had the privilege of watching it, and I don't want to give too much of it away because I think although it's a documentary, it's good to go in there with an element of surprise. But talk a little bit about what the film's about, what the title refers to, and how you got involved in it.
Well, the film is about it's the story of my friend and colleague, Ajmal Naqshbandi, and he was kidnapped and murdered by the Taliban 2 years ago. And, that much of the story is not, left to suspense. We say that right up front in the film. But, as part of my work reporting in Iraq and Afghanistan, I frequently brought a crummy little video camera just to make home movies. So I actually had a lot of footage of me and Ajmal. And then Ian Olds, who's the producer and director of the movie, is a guy that I met in Iraq through our mutual friend, Garrett Scott, who's a filmmaker who passed away a couple years ago. But Ian and Garrett made a film together, and then they came to Iraq and made a film called Occupation Dreamland. And Garrett had come to Iraq at my urging, and he and I traveled there together once, and then he and Ian and I all met up there. And then, so they made that film, and I started reporting as well from Afghanistan and working with Ajmal Naqshbandi, staying. He had a guest house. He was a 24-year-old, fast-rising journalist and fixer, and had a guest house in Kabul that he ran with his brother, where he stayed, and then also had kind of like a network of friends who also spoke English and worked as fixers, which is to say, helping journalists with translation and arranging, i.e. fixing interviews. So then Garrett Scott died, and Ian and he were planning some sort of film in Afghanistan, and Ian came just sort of looking around for a film to do and sort of followed Ajmal and I for a while, not intending really to make a movie about us, but sort of hoping that we'd happen upon some news that he might then turn into a film, or maybe he'd make a film about journalism more broadly. So we spent like 6 weeks in Afghanistan. I was reporting for The Nation and got back from that trip. And then shortly after that, Ajmal was kidnapped while he was arranging an interview with the Taliban down in Helmand province. He was with an Italian journalist named Mastro Giacomo from La Repubblica. And Ajmal and I had done a very similar interview outside of Kandahar, less than a year before he and Mastro Giacomo were kidnapped. So there then ensued a whole kind of like drama around the kidnapping of these two journalists, and that being Ajmal Naqshbandi and Daniel Mastro Giacomo.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, what happened was, I can get into the details of it later if you want, but in the end what happened was Mastro Giacomo was released because the Italian government put pressure on Karzai to give 5 Taliban prisoners in exchange for the 2 prisoners. And there's also some money changed hands. I think it was the $2 million. And at the last minute, for bizarre reasons, Ajmal was held back from the exchange. And up to that point, we had all the journalists who knew him and had worked with him and worked with like his network of friends. One of the guys who's in the film is named Nakib Sherzad, and he'd also worked with me and various other journalists. But so we all were sort of quiet, as is the thing to do when someone is kidnapped, so it's not raise their value. But once Mastro Giacomo was released and Ajmal was held, then there began, with the help of the Committee to Protect Journalists, a sort of cause celeb grew up. And there was a campaign to sort of appeal to the Taliban to get them to release Ajmal. And we didn't at the time know why he had been held and Mastro Giacomo released and what the deal was. And after 2 weeks of that, and maybe because of our then desperate efforts to bring attention to Ajmal's case, the Taliban decided to kill Ajmal, and they decapitated him. And so after that happened, Ian and I went back to investigate what had happened, and I wrote a story for Playboy about Ajmal and about the whole story of his kidnapping, which for me in many ways was a metaphor of the larger situation in Afghanistan. And Ian sort of followed that investigation, and out of that came this film. And what happened was there was sort of a kind of a screw-up in the whole thing. This sounds totally surreal and like something out of a spy novel, but this is how war really works. So basically, the Taliban were demanding 5 prisoners in exchange for these 2 captives they held. And the Karzai government was negotiating secretly with the Taliban and the Afghan government and the Italian government against the wishes of the United States, which the U.S. government does not make exchanges for prisoners. And if you are an American and you're kidnapped, they're not going to like pay any money to get you out or anything like that. So they were the American government was explicitly urging Karzai not to negotiate, not to participate in this, and had already become very angry with Rome for doing this several times in Iraq. So amidst this crazy negotiations, nobody checked to see, wait, now who are these 5 prisoners that the Taliban want? And at the last minute when they went to get the prisoners, it turned out that one of them was a high-level former Taliban spokesman who had been captured and switched sides and was giving tons of information to Afghan intelligence and NATO forces. And at the last minute, the secret police who controlled this guy said, well, we can't give this guy back or he'll be killed. So they substituted the Taliban commander's little brother, who they also had in captivity. And it seems that at the last minute, the Taliban were like, wait a minute, where is this guy that we wanted to kill, who had switched sides? And so that's why they held Ajmal back. And they were explicitly demanding that prisoner in exchange. And so once the initial exchange had been made, then the U.S. condemned Rome formally, got very angry with Karzai, and Karzai said, well, we're not, no more negotiations, we're not going to do anything. But in fact, at the last minute, he was prepared to give them more prisoners, but the Taliban decided that it would be, and according to one of our main sources, and this is in the film, it, apparently a call came from Pakistani intelligence, you know, that they had decided with the Taliban leadership in Pakistan that it would be better for their cause to make Karzai look like a puppet of foreign powers who didn't care about an Afghan, who was willing to move heaven and earth to release an Italian journalist but was willing to let an Afghan die. So the Taliban actually killed Ajmal before their own deadline, supposedly on orders of the ISI, the Pakistani intelligence service. So anyway, that's the kind of the detailed nature of, I mean, the film doesn't necessarily get into all those details, but the film is about how journalism is done in a war zone, what the work of a fixer is. It's about Ajmal, who he was, and also about this case, and hopefully, you know, trying to use this specific story to make larger points about the chaos in Afghanistan and the nature of the regime, the Karzai government, and the nature of the war. And we worked in some, you know, history about the Soviet occupation and the U.S. role in building up an earlier generation of Pashtun guerrillas, the Mujahideen, some of whom are now in Karzai's government, some of whom are now with the Taliban.
Our guest today on Media Matters, you've just been listening to Christian Parenti, the American investigative journalist, author of a number of books on the prison crisis, on civil liberties, on the Iraq occupation, and now just talking about the new film Fixer, the documentary. The harrowing tale took place 2 years ago that's documented about the journalism in the war zone and the details of an Afghani journalist and his execution. Our guest was taking phone calls. This is a live show, so if you'd like to call in with questions or comments for Christian Parenti, the number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And, you know, we hear a lot about journalists in Afghanistan and Iraq. You've been in both places, Christian Parenti. When you were over there a couple of years ago, and I don't know how much time you've been in Afghanistan or how recently, but what is the lay of the land for foreign correspondents right now in Kabul or in Afghanistan? How many of them are covering it, and how much of the country can they actually see, especially American journalists?
Well, I haven't been to Afghanistan for like a year and a half, but I did four extended trips there, and over about the course of 3 or 4 years, and, you know, spent about 10 months or almost a year there over those trips. The situation has steadily deteriorated, and it's even worse now than when I was last there. But when I was last there, you cannot travel outside of Kabul to the south. The provinces, Wardak and Logar provinces, which border Kabul to the west and just to the south, are controlled by the Taliban. So, I mean, literally 20 minutes outside of the city is controlled by the guerrillas. So journalists cannot travel there. I mean, we did occasionally go to those places and interview people, but since the kidnapping of Ajmal and then also of David Rhodes and other journalists, it's become impossible to go meet the Taliban for the most part. Also, a British filmmaker named Sean Lanigan was also kidnapped and held for a long time. So the entire southern half of the country is pretty much no-go unless one is embedded or, you know, to some extent, you know, maybe in Kandahar City or in Lashkargah, which is the capital of Helmand. One is safe, but just you could not drive from Kabul to Kandahar and not expect serious trouble. The Taliban are as much an ethnic movement as they are a religious movement. We often think of them just in terms of their religious politics, but their base is the Pashtun of the south, the Pashtun people, who are the majority minority in Afghanistan. They make up 42% of the population and control the southern half of the country. And then to the north are other ethnic groups, the Tajiks, the Uzbeks, the Hazara. And the Pashtun also live on the other side of the border in Pakistan. And thus, there's this whole history of Pashtun armed columns crossing back and forth that border, and thus there's a Taliban organizations in Pakistan as well as Afghanistan. In the north, you know, security is also deteriorating, but it's under the control of warlords like Mohammad Atta and Rashid Dostum, so they receive considerable subsidies from the West, so they're not interested in alienating Western journalists.
Christian, when you were there, roughly how many U.S. Foreign correspondents were in Afghanistan at the same time who were working not as necessarily freelancers but actually employed by traditional commercial news media or public news media for that matter?
Well, during big events, you know, everybody would come, like the circus would show up, myself being part of that. The first time I went there was for the 2004 elections. So in times like that, there would be, you know, Christian Amanpour would be there and everybody. But then, in, you know, like just the normal times, the dead of winter, there aren't that many people there. There would, you know, be a handful of journalists from the print media.
And, you know, usually the critique goes that U.S. correspondents working in countries like Afghanistan, the coverage they're going to get is going to be heavily skewed towards what U.S. sources tell them in Afghanistan. Was that your experience, or is that unfair to those journalists?
That wasn't how I reported it, and I don't think that.
No, actually, I'm not referring to you personally. No, I'm referring more to.
I don't think that's fair. Really, I mean, there's some really good journalists there. I mean, you know, Anthony Shadid, I think, has been in there, but I know Rajiv Chandrasekharan from the Washington Post has done good stuff there. Griff Witt from the Washington Post was there for a while, and I think that some of that is also the editors. You know. What kinds of stories they want and what they're focused on. And if editors are telling journalists that, you know, it's all about the government and you know, the U.S. relationship to the Karzai government, then that can end up being the nature of the story. But there are, you know, plenty of people who go out and interview regular Afghans. But, you know, it's also hard for journalists to get stories past their editors, to get them to be interested in, you know, the lives of Afghans in and of themselves, rather than how they relate to American sources and American organizations.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Christian Parente. You've just been listening to the investigative journalist who is involved with, the star of, I guess star is sort of a strange way to put it,
no,
but
I'm
featured
not.
In. Let's put
like,
it that
I'm
way.
The, yeah, I'm the field producer. It's like,
field producer of the new documentary Fixer, which is one large praise. He's also the author of three books and writes frequently for The Nation magazine. It's a pleasure to have him on the show. The phone number here, by the way, at Media Matters, 333-9455, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. And our guest, Christian Parente, is equipped to talk on a broad range of political issues that he's been covering for the past decade, including the prison crisis, civil liberties, the war in Iraq. But I do want to talk about Afghanistan a bit more because since you left Afghanistan a year and a half ago, it has become a larger war theater for the United States. President Obama ran on the platform to increase the war there, to win it decisively, and he has so far begun the steps to, in fact, increase the size of the U.S. presence there. What's your sense of that as a policy? And secondly, if there's something you have a private meeting with President Obama could tell him about Afghanistan, you think he doesn't necessarily understand, what would it be?
Well, I think it's insane as a policy. I don't think that the Obama administration believes that they're going to win in Afghanistan, and occasionally they say that. I mean, I think that basically victory in Afghanistan for the Obama administration is Obama's reelection in 3.5 years or 3 years, and that to do that they have to put a sort of like a credible show on, you know. I mean, I think that essentially to understand Afghanistan, you just have to understand understand the Obama administration's position on Afghanistan and Pakistan is to just understand the pathology that's at the heart of the Democratic Party, which is that they live in mortal terror of being called wimps by the Republicans. So I think they just made a decision that you can't lose two wars simultaneously. So they're going to withdraw from Iraq, except leave some air assets there, which is, you know, probably quite to the liking of the Maliki government. And to cover themselves politically in terms of, you know, electoral theater, they're going to make this big effort in Afghanistan and, you know, probably try and push the Taliban back from Wardak and Logar provinces, those provinces right around Kabul I mentioned earlier, try and secure the road from Kabul to Jalalabad on the Pakistani border, you know, make a little bit of progress, and then get reelected here in the U.S., and then begin the process of disengaging. And, you know, you'll probably hear the same kind of stuff that we first heard coming from John Kerry about Iraq. It's sort of like, you know, gee, after all we've done for them, they're not stepping up and taking care of it themselves, and time to take them off welfare and remove our troops. I suspect that's what will happen in Afghanistan, because I don't think that the Obama administration really thinks they're going to win militarily against the Taliban. And I don't think they are stupid enough to really think that the institutions of the Afghan state are going to actually function, because it's, you know, considered one of the most corrupt governments in the world. Like Transparency International does these ratings every year, as do some other NGOs. And it's, I mean, the corruption in the Afghan government is appalling. It's so corrupt that different pieces of the government bribe each other. A friend of mine worked in the Ministry for Women's Affairs, and to get the license plates for their cars, which they would need to avoid getting shaken down by cops at checkpoints, they had to bribe the transportation ministry. So that kind of stuff, that's just, you know, the government is rife with corruption. Many of its key leaders are implicated in drug trafficking. And Karzai's own brother, Wali Karzai, who for a while was the governor of Kandahar, is involved in drug trafficking and raising poppy. I asked a British intelligence officer about this once, one of my sources, and, you know, I said, how do you know this? And they had various ways of knowing it. He said, oh, but you, he said, you know the simplest way? You drive across his land, and it's covered in poppy. So, I mean, it's like just totally open. So, you know, nothing gets done. The Afghan government has very limited ability to raise taxes of its own. It can tax some traffic at the borders. Most, it gets like about 95% of its income comes from foreign aid, and very little for the people, for the society, is produced with that. Most of it is stolen. So I don't think the Obama administration thinks that they can turn that institution into a functioning government. So maybe I'm very, very cynical, but I think that they're really cynical. I think that the Obama administration is basically putting up a good show of trying in Afghanistan for several years so they can get reelected, and then they'll probably just let it fall back into chaos.
So if I can put a finer point on this, Christian Prentice, so I understand what you're saying. You're saying basically that the United States, in your view, probably at some point, probably after the 2012 election, will begin the withdrawal and say, okay, now it's up to you guys. And they won't get a different deal, really, than they could get if they were to do it today. But cynically, they're doing it just to get through the next election, regardless of whatever the human and economic cost might be.
Yeah, that's exactly what I think. And I think one of the main, you know, one of the really dangerous things is that the escalation of the war in Pakistan could really spin out of control and undermine the stability of the Pakistani state. And the U.S. has been giving all this money to the Pakistani military, gave $10.8 billion to the Pakistani military to fight terrorism and hunt down al-Qaeda. And, you know, it was shown that, it was in the New York Times, it was everywhere, you know, that the majority of that money was diverted to conventional weapons and the Pakistani posture against India, and a lot of it was also stolen by corrupt officers. So they keep giving money to this institution, which is not, you know, doing anything useful with it, bombing, you know, and hunting with drones and other airplanes for al-Qaeda and Taliban leadership, and occasionally killing them, as it seems to be the case with Batula Masood over the last couple of days. It seems like he was killed. But along the way, you know, killing lots and lots of civilians and infuriating wide sections of Afghan and Pakistani society. And
You know, Christian Purdy, if I can interrupt for a second, you know, when we talk about Afghanistan and Iraq now, sometimes I recall that I have children who are teenagers, one of them, one's in their early 20s. And for them, we've been at war over their whole lives, it seems like. And it's almost like in 1984 where you're battling Eurasia permanently. No one knows why exactly. And, you know, the ostensible reason we're in Afghanistan was to defeat Al-Qaeda, the terrorist responsible for 9/11. Were we to leave, the United States to leave from Afghanistan now, would that have an appreciable effect on the war on terrorism, on the success of Al-Qaeda? I mean, how important is Afghanistan to the so-called war on terror or to the notion of Al-Qaeda as a terrorist threat to the United States?
That's a tough question. I mean, just maybe to put it in a historical context, I mean, you know, Al-Qaeda does exist. I mean, some on the left sort of, you know, sometimes want to wish it away. But, like, I mean, it does exist. There is a network of internationalists on the Afghan-Pakistani border. And during the late Taliban regime, they had become quite close to the governing circle and, you know, seemed to be even playing, like, an advisory role to the Taliban. Apparently, they were instrumental in the Taliban regime's decision to destroy the Buddhist statues in Bamiyan Valley, these giant ancient Buddhist statues that were blown up. And so it's not that everything will be fine when the U.S. leaves, but I think that basically the strategy we're using now is just going to engender broader chaos. I mean, we can already see it happening in Pakistan. I mean, what would be better would be for the U.S. to try and, you know, well, what would have been better would for the U.S. to have moved much more slowly, spent much more money in Afghanistan, and worked with a broader section of the society, and instead of using just the old Mujahideen warlords who succeeded in hijacking the government and turning it into this kleptocracy. And right after 9/11, there was a conference called the Bond Conference, in which a wide array of Afghan expatriates, the whole diaspora, came together along with the international community, meaning, you know, sort of NATO states and large NGOs, to plan out the reconstruction of Afghanistan. And at that time, there was actually, you know, a lot of sort of Afghan technocrats who'd been living in the West who were willing to participate, even old ex-communists, there's still some of those people in the government. And there were a lot of people other than these drug-dealing fundamentalist warlords who were willing to participate and work and try and rebuild their country. And that opportunity was squandered because the Bush administration rushed the whole process and used Afghanistan, much as the Obama administration is, as a prop in its domestic theater. So you get Karzai has his election, even though many people said the Afghan society wasn't ready for that first election. You know, that election happened a month before Bush's reelection, so that he could have this trophy to bring to the American voters. If that whole process had been done differently and there was, like, you know, more space for civil society and something like a functioning state, then I mean, that would be a way of really dealing with the deeper causes that drive resentment and provide the chaotic situations in which Al-Qaeda shelters.
Well, let me just wrap.
I don't really know what the and I'm not sure anyone does know really what the nature of Al-Qaeda's threat to the U.S. is. I mean, clearly there were those attacks, and, you know, Osama bin Laden does seem to be alive and on the border with Pakistan and Afghanistan.
It's impossible to know that. Our guest today, Christian Parenti, the investigative journalist, featured in the new documentary Fixer, which is going to be on HBO. Is that right?
Yeah, it's going to be on HBO on August 17th, and then it'll be running. You know, they're going to rebroadcast it several times, and it'll be on demand.
Mm-hmm.
And then hopefully we'll have it on DVD.
Christian Parenti, also the author of several books about the war in Iraq, the occupation of Iraq, about the prison crisis in the United States, and about the state of civil liberties and privacy in the United States, a history of that. Writes for The Nation magazine. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment, the number here at Media Matters is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. My name's Bob McChesney. I'm your host. Let's go to our phone line right now for our first caller. Line 1, Champaign County. Thank you for your patience here on the air with Christian Parenti.
Hi. Admire your work a lot. But I'm wondering, your construction of this is mainly driven by internal politics belies the fact that the enduring bases idea, you mentioned earlier that in Iraq you thought that air assets would only be left. I think it'll be more than that, and I think that there'll be always some easy way to say that there's instability, and Maliki is already saying that, you know, we'll negotiate further extensions and et cetera, et cetera. He's the right guy for our job, despite the fact that he's buddies with Iran. So it just seems to me that both places, the U.S. wants to have enduring bases of much more than, you know, because it can't rely on a completely client comprador regime in either place, because there's just so much widespread opposition to that kind of thing. So it just seems to me that I don't think it's all driven by the need to make it look like an effort was made or something like that. I think
but it was about the escalation, you know. It was not about, like, what the overall logic of... I mean, I think you're right. I think the U.S. does want to have bases, particularly in Iraq, particularly in the Gulf. And I think it will have, you know, some sort of permanent footprint there. But I think it's actually going to be because Maliki will have come up with a way of using it for his own ends and his own project of internal pacification. But and it's also important to remember, in terms of Iraq, you know, the Maliki government was not a government chosen by the United States. Those elections were forced upon the U.S. because the Shiite went into the streets and protested and demanded that there be elections. And then, surprise, surprise, the Shiite parties, they being the majority in Iraq, won. And that government doesn't always do everything that it is told to do. Like, it hasn't basically just given away all of its oil wealth. I mean, yes, it's allowing in foreign firms for servicing contracts and all that, but it's like... it's not giving away the oil the way many U.S. Petroleum companies would like them to do. The U.S. would like to have bases. I think the main base of interest in Afghanistan is Shindad, which is outside of Herat, and it's right on the Iranian border. But I think the U.S. could do that without this Obama escalation. I think the Obama escalation is a lot of that's about theater. And just because the U.S. wants to have permanent bases, I'm not sure it's going to be able to maintain that. I mean, if the situation really deteriorates in Afghanistan, at some point, I think the U.S. is probably going to have to leave. If it's two bases, like one in Bagram and one out in Shindad, are being, you know, besieged, and it's, you know, everything has to be flown in, I mean, I don't know. We'll see.
Well, Christian Prenti, you just said that you've said before in the program that things have been going downhill for the United States in Afghanistan for the last couple of years. If the Obama administration strategy is to patch it together to get them through November 2012, is that maybe something outside of their control if it keeps unraveling?
Yeah. I mean, it is outside of their control. That's my cynicism.
But then they're on sort of they can't really get off this path they've put themselves on so publicly in the past 6 months, can they?
No, they can't. He ran on this. Remember, it was like, I'm going to fight the good war. I'm going to end Iraq. Iraq was the unpopular war. Public opinion was in favor of withdrawing from Iraq. And so he very clearly in his discourse linked Afghanistan and Iraq, you know. And the subtext was like, I am not a wimp. You know, I am willing to kill and send young people to their deaths. Don't call me a wimp just because I'm you know, prepared to lose Iraq. And at that time, Iraq looked like it was, still in the grips of intense civil war. I mean, there's still a civil war in Iraq, obviously. But the situation has stabilized considerably under the kind of the new despotism of the Maliki government. But, it's hard to predict the future. There are U.S. interests, clearly. The caller, I think, pointed them out correctly. But U.S. interests alone do not dictate the events of history. You know, there's a lot of pushback, and I think at a certain point it will be probably unfeasible for the U.S. to to continue an occupation in Afghanistan.
Our guest again, Christian Parenti, is joining us on the phone from Brooklyn, I take it, Christian?
Actually, I'm in Vermont right now.
Oh, in Vermont, okay.
I live in Brooklyn, yeah.
And, you know, I noticed in your biography that you are actually a PhD in sociology. How did you end up as a journalist?
Well, I went to the London School of Economics and studied sociology, and I taught college for a while out in California, and I always did journalism along the way, and I actually started doing journalism in radio at KPFA and then also WBAI. And when I finished the PhD and I had a series of postdocs that allowed me to go to New York, and I was at the CUNY Graduate Center in these seminars, and I just started reporting heavily from Iraq and Afghanistan, and it was, you know, being in these seminars while these wars were going on kind of became untenable, and so the journalism that I had always been doing, you know, pulled me away. So I had to take my foot out of the academia boat and put both feet in the journalism boat, at least for the moment. But
is it difficult to find ways to support the sort of journalism you do, which obviously isn't inexpensive to spend time in Iraq or to spend time in Afghanistan, to take the many months it oftentimes takes to do the necessary research to compile quality reports?
Yeah, it is. It's very hard. And it's, you know, and the Nation magazine and the Nation Institute funded a lot of those trips, which was sort of unprecedented for them. But I think they felt that foreign policy, you know, and foreign affairs had come front and center during those Bush years. So they made the effort. But, yeah, it's very difficult. And it's getting all the more difficult, as I'm sure you discuss frequently on this show, with the implosion of various revenue models for the media. And also now I think, you know, people are really sick of the rest of the world, of war, of, you know, the Middle East. And so maybe audiences, but certainly I think many editors are turning inward again towards the U.S., so it's getting more difficult to...
Yeah, not to dwell on this, but because that's the point I was getting at earlier with the reference to 1984. I mean, it's sort of a bizarre world we're in which we're fighting two fairly major wars across the other side of the planet, and they've been going on, and no one can really explain exactly why we're in the wars anymore, but they're not stopping either.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's an insane situation. I mean, there are layers of interest, you know. It's like, I mean, there's obviously the military contractors have done very well out of this. The Bush administration was very good to them, and the war was what allowed that. You know, nobody was going to question any of those defense appropriations. The military budget increased by, like, what was it? I think, like, you know, at least 50% under Bush. There are various interests that benefit. There's, like, you know, the petroleum interests that were eager to see Iraq opened up. But I don't think that alone drove the war. There's the geostrategic interests, you know, like trying to control the oil supply, the primary oil supply that the other two poles of world capitalism, the European Union and the rising economies of Asia, India, and China are dependent on, you know. And that the project on a new American century, basically the Bush administration foreign policy team in waiting, when they wrote in 1997 their open letter to President Clinton called Rebuilding America's Defenses, you know, they basically, that and in other papers, made the case for trying to situate the U.S., trying to situate U.S. military power as the kind of security arbiter, the petroleum gendarme in the Gulf, not just so that American corporations could possibly have access to the wealth, but so that the other two poles in the world economy would be dependent and beholden to U.S. military power somehow. And so there's all these interests that run simultaneously, and some of which are connected, some of which aren't, some of which overlap neatly, some of which not so neatly. There is also, I think, the political calculus and machination of, you know, of the Obama administration, and that, in terms of the escalation, the current escalation in Afghanistan, I think that is what explains it.
Let's go back to our phone lines right now. We have a caller who's been waiting patiently on line four. Fryna, you're on the air with Christian Parenti.
Hi. Thanks once again for another great show. Christian Parenti, is not your father Michael Parenti?
He is indeed, yes.
Okay. If you could say a word or two about him. But what I called about was I saw a lecture on the UCTV channel from the author, I can't remember his name, of a book called Three Cups of Tea that was...
Greg Mortensen.
It was just an eye-opening lecture. He is, you know, he approached the Afghan people that he met as human beings, and what do they want? I just thought that was such an eye-opener, And my thought on the Afghan problem is, you know, instead of this war, quote unquote war paradigm, how about a law, bring the troops out and bring a law enforcement approach to the control the illegal heroin trade, and to me, maybe subsidize a medical marijuana trade in its place. And how about just a law enforcement approach to the gun and drugs trade, instead of this brutal military thing that alienates everybody, including the Americans.
Yeah.
And if you could say a couple words about your father, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, caller Christian Parenti.
I think that what implied in this question is sort of like what would be a solution. I think like a reasonable solution is that the only thing that could possibly work is for a grand bargain in which all of the problems of the region are connected. So that means there has to be a settlement. There has to be a Palestinian state. There has to be a settlement between Israel and Palestine, because that inflames public opinion around the world, throughout the Muslim world, throughout the Middle East. That is part of what drives anger and causes people to join the resistance in Iraq and the Taliban in Afghanistan. I mean, I remember being in Wardak province with former Taliban who said that. He said, "You know, why does your government give so much money to Israel? It seems like you guys are just making war on Muslims everywhere." And all the way through, and at the other end of that region, there's the question of Pakistan and India. You know, and Pakistan funds the Taliban, supports the Taliban, and has used Pashtun guerrillas against Afghanistan since the mid-70s, since before the before the communist coup, before the Soviet intervention. Part of why they do that is because it's part of their strategy vis-a-vis India. They want to have a weak neighbor on the other side, Afghanistan. So the only way Pakistan is really going to work for the stability of Afghanistan is if there's some sort of security guarantee with India. So that has to be dealt with. And a grand bargain would essentially have to be a peace conference on the scale of, you know, Paris 1919 at the end of World War I, but not with that kind of imperial logic, but with some sort of peace-building, de-escalating logic. And so everybody with an interest in the region would have to be there. Iran, Russia, China, India, if all of those nations could, you know, negotiate some sort of de-escalation and each give guarantees and make exchanges of power, then you could move towards a de-escalation of all of the instability in that region. But I do think it actually has to be linked. It has to be the whole thing or nothing at all. You know, that there can't be just a single strategy for Pakistan. I mean, there has to be a whole new approach to the entire region. And that would not be impossible to do, but it would mean a fundamental transformation of the logic of American foreign policy, and I don't expect that to happen.
About your father, Michael Parenti?
Well, he lives in Berkeley, and he's writing continually, he was a big influence on me. Being raised in a political family was a big part of who I am and how I got my worldview.
Well, Christian Parenti, your first two books were on the prison crisis and were on the state of surveillance in the United States, a history of it. In recent weeks, there's been a considerable increase of writing, especially online in the blogosphere, about the prospect of fascism in the United States or totalitarianism, I think inspired by, to some extent, by the far-right response to the election of President Obama. And, you know, you've probably done more on the sort of nuts and bolts of prisons and surveillance than anyone I know. What is your sense of the political climate today and what sort of threats we face?
Well, I mean, I don't think that that you know, fascism is imminent. I mean, I do think that, as I've written in these various books, you know, there's been a long, slow development towards greater and greater surveillance and reliance on the police. And I think, you know, that certainly has a fascistic quality to it. And I'm deeply troubled by that. But, you know, on the flip side, there are some positive changes. And we were beginning to see some changes around public perceptions of law and order and the use of prisons and surveillance right before 9/11. People would sort of had enough of the war on drugs. There was an elite rethink. You know, the New York Times started editorializing against the war on drugs. Ted Koppel did those really great documentaries criticizing excessive use of prison, criticizing the horrendous conditions that American prisoners face. And then 9/11 came along, and the entire project of domestic surveillance and repression got a new lease on life. But, you know, I think that you're again beginning to see a return of that critical position. People are, you know, accepting the fact that, you know, you can have medical, essentially de facto decriminalization of marijuana in California, and the sky didn't fall. And then the fiscal crisis in many states is forcing politicians to behave more rationally in terms of, like, trying to let nonviolent offenders out of prison, that sort of stuff. So there's been a long trend towards a kind of American-style authoritarianism that is fundamentally racist, fear-mongering, and like a political cancer. But there are these other features in our political culture that have not been snuffed out, and I actually feel a little more hopeful in recent months about that than I have in a while. And I think that, you know, the question of marijuana decriminalization is essential in kind of, you know, recalibrating law and order in the U.S. And I think a lot of people are just sick of it. You know, I'm like, here in my hometown where I was originally raised, in Putney, Vermont, and these small New England towns, you know, they're like covered in cops now. It was never like that. And people don't like it, you know. They don't like getting tickets for not having their seatbelts on. And that's, people are sort of connecting that. Like, that's what happens if all you do is elect fear-mongering politicians who want to throw more and more money at the police and prisons, then everybody's life becomes much more difficult. And I think that's one of the reasons that there's something of a rethink beginning again.
Christian Parenti, you worked with The Nation, you published in The Nation, they supported your research, and The Nation has had sort of, as a publication, and I think representing sort of the left liberal progressive community in many respects and the range of debate in that community, has had, you know, a supportive relationship to Obama and the Democratic Party, but also has been, I think, well to Obama's left on virtually every major issue of his administration. Do you think, what is your attitude towards the Obama administration at this point? Are they pretty much what you expected? Are you disappointed? Where do you stand?
I didn't expect that much. I'm not a total Obama hater, much to the disappointment of many of my friends. One thing I would say is, let's remember, I'm very disappointed. He's not stepping up fundamentally to, like, what I think is the most important question, which is dealing with climate change. Everything else is contingent on that. I'm actually writing a book about violence and climate change right now. And, he has not led properly on that. But on the other hand, a lot of the problem are the centrist Democrats, you know, the people who represent hospital corporations, who represent coal interests within the Democratic Party that are creating bad legislation like the Waxman-Markey bill, the climate bill. It's a bad bill, and it probably shouldn't pass, not only because its carbon emissions reductions goals are too little, but it does actually negative things like strips the EPA of powers to regulate specific sources of pollution around coal. It would change it so that the EPA would have to sort of regulate the entire sector as a single entity rather than be able to target and shut down particularly dirty coal plants. I mean, that is a very, very bad thing. It might sound like, you know, administrative inside baseball, but it's actually one of the few ways in which there's been progress, is the EPA and environmentalists suing and shutting down and preventing the construction of specific coal plants. So, I mean, I'm very disappointed in many ways, but it's not just, you know, President Obama. The Democrats have a lot of power, and we're seeing the profound pathologies that are at the heart of that party. And, it, you know, it's a party that includes people who are basically socialists, like, you know, my representative from Greenpoint, Williamsburg in Brooklyn, Nydia Velasquez, is, you know, very, very good politically. And then you've got people who are basically Republicans in the same party. So that, I think, is a serious problem, the centrist Democrats and their obvious unwillingness to use their mandate to move in a progressive direction around health care, around the environment, and numerous other issues that will be coming up.
Christian Prati, how much of the problem, in your view, is that the Democratic Party is an entity the opposition party it faces is well to its right, and so there's all the pressure that is to move in that direction, the gravitational pull. There's nothing on the other side.
Yeah, I mean, that's the opposition party is better organized. They take, I mean, Republicans and the right in the United States take ideas seriously. They set the terms of debate, and the Democrats do not wage the battle for ideas as vigorously and as clearly as they should. And when they do, it has remarkable effect. Like when Obama was pushing for the public option and, you know, was sort of being a wimp about it and silent, and then the one time he came out and pushed back, he said, well, what is it? You know, are you guys really afraid that you can't, if the market is so good, why can't you compete against this public option? Like, which one is it? The state is awful and inefficient and fails at everything, or the state is this efficient thing that would snuff out private insurers? Like, you know, he called them out, called out the right on their contradictions, and, you know, that for a moment was really pushing, you know, had some effect in moving the idea of a meaningful public option forward. But they don't do that because, one, their party is like sort of to some extent politically incoherent compared to the Republicans. There's not as clear a philosophy because you basically have, you know, right wing free market types who are in the Democratic Party, and also people who really would like to move in the direction of, like, you know, sort of like European style social democracy. And so I think they can't get a progressive message straight.
Christian Prati, we've only got about a little less than a minute. I just wanted, before we wrapped up today's show, what are some of the media you look to every day or every week to sort of stay on top of the world and the country? And who are some of the journalists that you really look to?
Well, I subscribe to the FT, Financial Times, and you know, I watch Democracy Now, and I read The Nation and The Guardian Weekly, and in terms of specific journalists, you know, I don't know. I mean, I read widely. Depends on the subject, but you know, Mark Herskov is very good in the environment. Jeremy Scahill's stuff on private security is really good. My friend Dar Jamail done stellar reporting from Iraq. And commentators, not journalists so much, but like Tariq Ali is very good on his writing in the London Review of Books.
Well, on that note, since Tariq Ali has been a guest on our program many times, I have to thank you very much, Christian Prati, for joining us today on Media Matters.
thanks for having me on.
Yeah, good luck with your book and the environment. We'll have you back on as soon as that is out. I'm Bob McChesney. I want to welcome our new producer to the show this week. Melissa Trentz has now taken over for Andrew Boyle, who's off on his way to upstate New York to begin his teaching career. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. We'll be back in 167 hours with Larry Lessig. Until then, everyone, have a great week.
Broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Here's the weather forecast for Champaign.